Howdy, y'all. This is Dr. Jeff Jarvis. I just got back to Central Texas from the gorgeous weather of San Diego. I had a great time at NMSP. Such an amazing conference. The presentations were incredible, and the business of the association made great progress at those committee meetings. Although, damn, 7 a.m. sure does come early. The real benefit to this conference, though, is getting to talk with all of our friends and colleagues in the hallways, at dinner, and of course, at the bar. And then there's the research. So much research. This is the conference if you're looking for where EMS research is presented. There were both poster and oral presentation sessions, and I had the opportunity to talk with some researchers about their work. Now, if you've ever been to a large conference poster presentation session, particularly one with an open bar and very echoey walls, you'll know how loud these things can be. I tried to record most of these interviews at quiet times. Well, quieter times. But I wasn't always able to. As a result, the audio for some of these interviews is not as good as I'd like. I think the benefit of the content, though, is worth the lower quality. And I hope you'll agree with me and forgive the background noise. We got as many interviews as we could, but there was so much great research and only so much time. There was a ton of work that I would have loved to talk about, and so many great researchers I wish I had the time to interview. Unfortunately, we just weren't able to get to everyone. I hope to find a better way of doing this next year, and if any of y'all have any ideas, please let me know. Despite missing so many researchers, we did get a bunch recorded. And because of this, this pod is going to be longer than our recent ones. We'll get back to the shorter format soon. But did I mention how much great research there was at this conference? All right, so I'm going to put up a copy of each abstract we talk about in the show notes. And I'm going to go over the title of each poster just prior to the start of the interview so you can go back and identify the abstract for the interview. Now, one last thing before we get started, I'd like to congratulate my friend Dr. Rimley Crowe for winning the Best Research Presentation Award for her work on stroke screens. And would you believe it? We got to chat with her about that work. So stick around and we'll get right into our interviews after these wonderful words from Ginger.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Our first abstract is presented by Ryan Schroeder. The title of the abstract is Evaluating the Utility of Pre-Hospital Shock Index and Modified Shock Index to Predict Hospital Sepsis and Septic Shock Diagnosis. The lead author is Rimley Crowe, and it is presented by Ryan Schroeder. Ryan is a graduating senior at Texas A&M University. Whoop. And they have a great paper. I'm very interested in this. So I'm going to ask Ryan to give us the spiel and let us know what they did. So what'd you find, Ryan?
All right. So our study was using shock index and modified shock index as predictors for predictors for sepsis diagnosis in the hospital. We looked at a few different factors, from our patients and looked at different variables, and we found that controlling for age, gender, race, and ethnicity, community size, and other things, that sepsis diagnosis, an elevated shock index or an elevated modified shock index leads to 5 times higher odds of sepsis diagnosis in the hospital.
Awesome. So the fundamental question you're asking, so take me back there, and what is the clinical question that you were trying to figure out here?
We're looking at can shock index and modified shock index, how do those perform as pre-hospital predictors?
Perfect. So it's a great clinical question. The tools that we have available for prediction right now, sepsis or SIRS scores, QSOFA, suck. They're horrible. So what you're talking about is using an objective measurement and seeing how well that predicts it. So I don't see that you did a comparison specifically, statistically, between shock index and modified shock index, but graphically, I can certainly see something here. So what did you find in terms of what the odds ratios were, the adjusted odds ratios, for shock index and for the modified shock index?
It wasn't necessarily comparing them to each other. It was just seeing where how each of them performed. And both of them, as I said, over five times higher odds of a sepsis diagnosis, and also septic shock is something we looked at, and both elevated shock index and elevated modified shock index were correlated with a nearly nine times increase in odds of septic shock diagnosis.
So, very good. If you don't mind, just tell us what, I think a lot of people are familiar with the shock index, but if you don't mind, just tell us how you calculated that. So they're objective data. Tell us what the formulas are.
Right. So shock index is just the a person's heart rate over the their systolic blood pressure. Modified shock index also takes into account the diastolic. So it's a uses a measure that takes both systolic and diastolic into account to come with a mean arterial pressure.
Okay, so the modified is heart rate over MAP, the mean arterial pressure.
Yes.
Perfect. So the big question for you here is what do you think the utility of this tool is? What's the takeaway? What's the important clinical point here?
So takeaway from this is that for EMS professionals, when they have a patient, when they're treating, when they're first giving treatment, and if there's not anything that stands out to them as what could be wrong to this person, this could be, you know, if you look at their shock index and modified shock index and see that, okay, this person's shock index is high, that lets them know that maybe that start treating them potentially for sepsis.
Awesome. Great, great paper. I actually like the visuals. That's very nice. So strong work. It looks like Tony Fernandez and Scott Bourne, speaking of Tony, who he just walked up here, were helping supervise this. I see Brent got his name on this poster also. So looks like some great stuff. Are you planning on going forward with a manuscript?
Yes.
I like the way you look over at Dr. Crow, and she's like, oh, yes, let me answer that for you. Well, awesome. Outstanding. So you are about to graduate with a degree in statistics. What are you going to do with that degree in statistics?
Get a job.
Okay. Are you planning on grad school?
No, right now I'm not. I'm just looking for a job. I'm not super sure like what area I want to go into yet, but we'll figure that out.
Fair enough. Well, I do have to ask you, and Rimley knows this question is coming. I don't see it on here. What statistical tool were you using?
We used R for a lot of the calculations.
So I want to go back and make sure I understand that. I don't think I heard that. Could you say that again? You used what?
We used R for this study.
Interesting. So you're in College Station, home of an inferior statistical program, STATA, and you chose to use R. That's outstanding. Well, so I knew he's an Aggie, and he's used, I think Rimley's about to hurt me. That's outstanding, R, perfect. Tidyverse? Are you a Tidyverse man?
I've used it a little bit.
Okay, well, we'll get you there. So congratulations, man. Congratulations on a good poster and on graduation.
Thank
you. And I'd also like to congratulate Rimley Crow and Tony Fernandez here, who are standing here and cheering everybody on. Thank you.
Our next interview is with Dr. Catherine Counts, and she is going to talk about some research that she did with her colleagues from the University of Washington School of Medicine. The title of the abstract is Artificial Intelligence in Emergency Medical Services. Can a machine learning framework improve the identification of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest during 911 calls?
Thank you for talking with us.
It's great to chat with you today.
Why don't you tell me about your paper here?
So I'm at Seattle Medic One, Seattle Fire Department, and about 2.5 years ago, we teamed up with a technology startup out of Copenhagen, Denmark, that thought they had a way to do speech-to-text machine learning framework building. and they recognized that they needed a tag, a flag of some sort, some kind of quantifiable clinical outcome that they could test for. And they realized that cardiac arrest was a pretty good yes-no question compared to, you know, say stroke or sepsis or trauma even. And so they started working with Copenhagen EMS, and then they branched out and said, like, we should learn English. And so we teamed up with them, and they have been taking our cardiac arrest calls and running it through their machine learning framework, which essentially converts audio to words on paper. And then the machine learning framework analyzes those words on paper. And once there's a certain threshold is reached, then the machine learning component says, this is a cardiac arrest, and it quote unquote activates. And they have been comparing their performance to our dispatch tapes and our dispatcher performance.
Okay.
And so this poster is kind of that round one of data, so to say.
Okay.
And so the way machine learning works is you essentially have a test case, and then you have kind of the education data set. And so our test case is from August 2017 through February 2018. And so you never train your machine learning framework on your test case. It's always novel information every time you run it through. And slowly but surely, we've been giving them more confirmed out-of-hospital cardiac arrest calls. Specifically, those are in cardiac arrest at the time of the 911 call, the stereotypical kind of things that EMS dispatchers should catch, and training their model to see if it can identify cardiac arrest as well or better than the dispatcher.
Okay. And what did y'all find?
It works.
Yeah?
Sometimes.
Okay.
So it works. It works a little bit better than the dispatcher.
Okay.
But the most important thing that we found is that when you combine the two and you say for any individual cardiac arrest, take the better performer, that's when you see the best performance.
Okay.
And so specifically, machine learning has a higher sensitivity and a similar specificity as trained telecommunicators.
Okay.
But we think we could have the highest sensitivity if we combine machine learning with the telecommunicator.
So use it as an adjunct and not a replacement.
Yeah, it's totally, it's a team. You cannot take the human out of this process. You need the human there.
So with this, with their algorithm, are they, I believe I heard you say that they are converting text to speech and then doing essentially natural language processing on the speech?
They're doing speech to text. So a 911 call is audio, right?
And it's I said text to speech, yeah. I'm sorry.
Would you like to repeat that?
I would. So okay. What they're doing is, that would require editing, which I won't be doing here. So they're taking words, audio, and converting that into text, and then doing natural language processing on the text. So they're not, and they're looking for words.
They're doing something called word vectoring.
Okay.
Among other vocabulary. We're about to get outside the scope of my knowledge on machine learning framework building. But yeah, they take that really messy, ugly 911 audio. Okay. I mean, everyone on your podcast has probably heard a 911 call before.
Oh, yeah.
And just, they're gnarly. And that's one of the reasons they wanted to work with us. Because it's like, it's one thing if you're in your podcast recording studio and you say, hey, my husband's lips are turning blue.
Right.
And a fool can figure that out. But when you've got the background noise, you've got the screaming baby, there's the sirens, there's a crashed car, maybe you're in the middle of a park somewhere or in a bathroom, it gets a little harder.
Yeah.
And the franticness of the voices. And so they ignore the outside noise and they just do the speech to text.
Okay.
And then from the text, they have a sense, like they have a measure of like, okay, when's our threshold for saying this is a cardiac arrest? That said, they are starting to work on building up their technology to detect things like agonal respirations. So we've been feeding them 911 calls. They have our 911 calls, but we've been feeding them timestamps because we're the neutral party, right?
Yeah.
We've been feeding them timestamps of when we can hear the agonals in the audio recording and saying, hey, this is these 10 timestamps is when an agonal respiration happened. Here's what an agonal respiration sounds like.
Awesome. Well, that was when I, so we weren't recording yet, but one of the things that I looked at, and I said, oh, is this the moans and groans? And what I meant by that was, other than the moans, groans, and psychic overtones that we learn in medical school, was looking for the moans and the agonal respirations and that type of thing, which also looks like it's showing some progress.
It's really exciting.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you your chatting and sharing your work with us.
No, absolutely.
My next interview is with Bryce Johnson. Bryce is one of my colleagues from Williamson County EMS. He's going to present his poster, Pre-Hospital Epidemiology and Treatment of Patients with Atraumatic Headache.
So this kind of all started from when I moved from the service that I came from to Williamson County. All we had at that service was fentanyl and Zofran for the treatment of atraumatic headaches. came here, we have a much bigger protocol, can do antidopaminergics, Tylenol, et cetera, and found that it was really effective. And so I approached Dr. Jarvis and said, hey, what can we do to study this to try to, you know, get this a little more standardized throughout the United States? So we decided to look at what United States is currently doing. So we started out, headaches are usually just starting. It's about 1 to 2% of EMS calls, a little bit higher in the emergency department setting. And the current EDs have a treatment guideline stating don't give opioids. So you don't want to give opioids. It has problems with recurrence of headache, opioid addiction, as well as longer ED length of stay.
So let's clarify that. You said the opioids, you're saying, do not work for headaches?
So they work, but they have a lot of problems.
They work for that headache.
They work for that headache,
but
have downstream problems. Exactly.
Okay. And what are those downstream problems?
Downstream problems are going to be increased recurrence of the headache, so you'll have more headaches happening.
Good.
You'll have longer ED lengths of stay. You'll be in the ED longer.
Yep.
And then you also have that last one.
Some more ED revisits.
Yes.
For the subsequent headaches.
ED revisits, and then the opioid addiction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, that's the other one. So our goal was just to describe how the current assessment and treatment of patients in the EMS setting with a traumatic headache.
Okay.
So we took the ASO data set that's available to researchers. We said, you know, just in 2018, so from January 1st to December 31st, inclusion, we said adults that had primary impression of headache or migraine. And then from there, we excluded, and so that with that, we got about 66,000 people.
Okay.
From there, we excluded a bunch of others for due to trauma, fever, ETOH or drugs, a non-paramedic crew, and the use of non-plausible drugs. And I'll get to that in just a little bit.
Okay.
And so all that combined, taking all that, left us with 34,000-ish.
Okay.
And what we were trying to do there is basically try to get rid of all of the non-benign reasons for headache.
Okay.
We want to just isolate the benign headaches and how we assess and treat those, because you may not want to treat somebody who's actively dying of their headache for their pain. So,
or we certainly might treat it differently.
We might try to we might treat it differently as well. So our outcome measure that we looked at, our primary outcome, was clinically significant reduction in pain score, which was a decrease in pain score of greater than or equal to 2.
So this is a binary outcome. Your outcome is either yes or no, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
The outcome is yes or no. Did it decrease by greater than or equal to 2, yes or no?
Interesting. Okay, so what'd you find?
So we found 1.1% of the almost 6 million calls we looked at, about 1.1% had a headache. When we excluded, we're left with about 34,000-35,000.
Okay.
We found that the median age was around 50. Most of them were female, 67%, with most of them being white at 51%.
Okay.
And there was a primary impression. They did headache, migraine, because there's two options in ESO. Majority was headache with 93%, with the leftover being migraine.
Okay.
The initial pain score was a median of 6.
Okay.
So that's, you know, 50% had pain score of 6.
Okay.
And what we found was that we gave patients with headache, after all the exclusions, any kind of treatment and further headache to treat the pain of the headache 3% of the time. So we were left over with 97% of patients that had an atraumatic headache did not get any analgesic medication to treat their headache.
Interesting.
Of those that we did decide you get to get treatment, 40% were given opioids, which we heard earlier is not good for the downstream effects.
Yeah.
So in essence, we're not treating headaches. And then when we rarely do, we're treating it wrong. So by drug class, if we look at the percentage that decreased their pain scale along with who was
given
what.
That had a clinically
significant reduction of pain. Opioids, given 40% of the time, had a clinically significant reduction of pain at 69% of the time.
Okay.
So it,
you know, so for that headache,
for that headache, it works. It works for that headache.
Yep.
I don't have any other data to say that their ED length of stay got worse or anything like that. I don't have
that's
any.
That's not in that data set.
Yeah, we don't have that in that data set.
Okay.
NSAIDs, which is the next most common class, given 26% of the time, it had a clinically significant reduction of pain at 38%.
Okay.
Followed by Tylenol
yep.
or acetaminophen.
Yep.
26% of the time was given, had a significant clinically significant reduction at 30%.
Okay.
And then anti-dopaminergic agents, which is what we use in Williamson County along with Tylenol, was given 10% of the time.
Okay.
With a clinically significant reduction of 44%. So the second most reduction, clinically significant reduction of pain.
So interesting. And I notice over here that you actually give us some ideas about the specific agents. It looks like the most common opioid was fentanyl.
Yes.
But it also looks like the most common anti-dopaminergic agent was promethazine.
Promethazine.
So do you think that that was actually given for the headache, or do you think it was given for a symptom of the headache?
Most likely it was not given to treat the headache itself.
Okay.
As we know, probably know that migraines come with nausea usually.
Yeah, fair enough.
So if you think of it that way, promethazine is usually used as an antiemetic to treat nausea. And so that's probably why it was given, and especially in the pre-hospital setting, the promethazine was probably given to treat the nausea with a side effect of, hey, look, their pain got better.
Yeah, and it's interesting. That's not the antidopaminergic agent we typically recommend.
Exactly.
So Compazine or Reglan are typically. So let me ask you this. It looks like even with that, the as a class, the antidopaminergics were the second most effective medication. Why do you think that? Because this is in contrast to what most of the literature says. Most of the literature, at least in the emergency department, says that antidopaminergic agents are equally effective as
fentanyl. Better.
Now, why do you suppose that we're seeing something different than that here?
So, unfortunately, when you are in the EMS setting, in the pre-hospital setting, you have a limited time with the patient, right? So, these antidopaminergic agents, they don't, you know, act like a snap.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit of time, about 15 minutes for it to take effect.
Whereas
fentanyl, you get that in one or 2 minutes, so you get the effect pretty immediately.
That's a good point.
So that's why you might be getting, might be seeing in our study that it's a little less effective.
So Bryce, what are the next steps here?
So the next steps, it would be
First off, are you going to publish this?
Yes, you can find it in JSEP Open.
Congratulations on the publication.
Thank you.
So next efforts, what are you going to do? What's the
so
next study?
Next study that we're going to work on is we're going to take our services data at Williamson County.
Yep.
We're going to do a interrupted time series, so a before and after cohort study to look at did the use of medications improve? Did we treat it more often, and did we use less opiates before a headache protocol was implemented and after a headache protocol was implemented?
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Outstanding. Well, Bryce, thank you very much. I appreciate you talking to me, and great work on this.
Yeah, thank you.
So our next interview is about some really interesting content. The problem is that the audio is probably the worst of any of these interviews. It was really loud, but the content is so good. This is with Dr. Shepke. He is presenting work he did with the great folks at Palm Beach County Fire Rescue, Coral Springs Parkland Fire Rescue, with some outstanding folks, Peter Antevi, Michael Perlmutter, Dr. Pepe, some really good folks. The title of this abstract is Sustained Prehospital Termination of Benzodiazepine Refractory Status Epilepticus with Parenteral Rescue Ketamine Administration. I just love a good poster with ketamine.
I'm here with the State Medical Director of Florida, Dr. Shepke. So this was born out of a question I received from one of my medics. Had already maxed out on Versed, and they were transporting a patient a pretty good distance, and the patient was in status epilepticus, and the answer is, what else can we do? And normally the answer is, you know, more diesel. But we do carry ketamine, and ketamine does actually work for seizures. It works by a different mechanism. So when you look at status epilepticus cases, and you look at medications that are used for seizure in general, mostly they are targeted to what's called the GABA receptor in the brain. And it turns out that Versed, Valium, Ativan, they generally work on the GABA receptor. And the longer you have a seizure, those GABA receptors get downregulated, so it's less likely that those medications are actually going to work. At the same time, another receptor in the brain called the NMDA receptor gets upregulated. And if you can block the NMDA receptor, that also blocks seizures. And guess what? Ketamine blocks the NMDA receptors. So it just turns out that physiologically, the longer you are in status epilepticus, theoretically, the more likely ketamine should work to get you back out of it, where benzodiazepines and other drugs like it have failed. So we put that in, that theory to work in Palm Beach County out on the street,
And we gave the standard of care, which is we give you 10 milligrams of Versed or the equivalent weight-based dose for children. And then if you were still seizing after that, we would follow that up with a dose of ketamine. Most of the cases were given IO or IV. And when we do IO, we mean humeral head IO. So it's
a good
flow rate. Yeah. And what we do is we take the ketamine, in this case, 100 milligrams, and we put in a 50 cc bag of saline. We hook it up to a 60 drop set and we run it wide open. And it turns out that whatever drug you put in a 50 cc bag with a 60 drop set run wide open runs in over 2 minutes. So that's our equivalent for a slow IV push.
Okay.
So when we did that, we found of the 22 cases that we had, 21 of them completely stopped the seizure. So we expect it to be effective, but this is even more effective than we were expecting.
So you said 21, and tell me your denominator again.
22.
So that's
almost
that?
All.
Yeah.
It's just about 96%. And when you look at the one case where it, quote, did not work,
right,
that patient was seizing continuously and actually slowed down the seizures. So if you want to say improvement, it's 100% improvement, although in the one case, they didn't completely break it. And I suspect, had we given a second dose of ketamine to that case, we probably could have blocked that one as well.
So no, the problem, though, is if you give ketamine, they're going to stop breathing, right? Well, so the sats are going to drop.
That's one of the things we looked at as well, because now you're giving two CNS depressants. You're giving ketamine on top of Versed. Now, we know ketamine alone is a pretty good safety profile for respiratory depression.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you combine ketamine with either alcohol or Versed in this case,
right,
then you have to worry about it. So we looked at hypoxia. That was one of our endpoints. And there were 5 cases that developed hypoxia, which we defined as an O2 sat less than 90. 2 out of the 5 had that before we even touched ketamine. So you can't really blame ketamine on that. That's the seizure itself makes respiratory drive, you know, it makes your mechanics of breathing less effective. There were 3 cases that developed hypoxia after the addition of ketamine. But every single one of them, it was self-limited. You had a little bit of oxygen. In most cases, just supplemental O2 was good. We had 1 case that they gave brief bag valve mask. And we did have 1 case that was intubated in the emergency department, where EMS did not feel the patient needed to be intubated. When you go back and look at it, the end-tidal CO2 is fine, the O2 sat is fine. So that was intubated, not really by hypoxia, but because of the discomfort of the ER's part for, quote, airway protection.
Or a desire for a rapid disposition.
Either way, but EMS did not feel that intubation was actually clinically indicated. So
consistent with other studies on ketamine. Yeah.
So bottom line, it was highly effective. It seemed to be very well tolerated, and it's a good option. After the standard of care benzodiazepines have already maxed out, you have something else in your armamentarium. Great way, and you did have a couple of cases that were given IM as well, and it worked IM as well as IV, as well as IO, all of them worked.
Yep.
The one case where it slowed it down but did not stop it was an IO case.
Okay.
So it's highly effective and very well tolerated. So I think it's another quiver in our that we can use.
Another arrow in the quiver. Benzo's clearly still first line.
Absolutely.
That gets most of them. Do you have an idea? Now, your denominator here was just patients who had already gotten, I believe, a max of 10.
Or the pediatric equivalent dose, yes.
Of Versed.
That's right.
Do you have an idea of what proportion of patients were getting Versed and were still in status despite maxing out?
So this is only the status epilepticus cases. The vast majority of seizures will stop either on their own or after Versed.
Yeah.
So this is a small fraction of seizure cases that now you've already done the max dose of the benzodiazepine. So I don't know what our total number of seizures are. It's a lot. This is a tiny fraction of them.
Okay. So a small fraction, but the key thing here is those are the ones that we really need to do something about.
Those are the ones that
the isolated seizure, they don't really need us at all.
That's right. Those are the ones that we didn't really have a good answer before, and now I think we've got a pretty good answer.
So when we go back to the desaturation, because if you look at the big trial on IM Versed, say, versus IV, the Rampart trial, they actually noticed that the big driver for hypoxia was ongoing seizures. And you're looking at this and you saw that there were some patients who had hypoxia. You mentioned that there were, I think, 5 with hypoxia. Do you happen to know what the proportion was?
Yeah, so it was a total of 5 cases, 2 of them before they even got ketamine. So you're absolutely correct. So we know that the mechanics of ventilation are negatively affected by ongoing seizure to begin with. So I don't know if there's even a cause and effect between the ketamine, because the seizure can make you hypoxic, Versed potentially can make you hypoxic. So there were 3 extra cases, 3 out of the 22 that developed an O2 sat less than 90, all brief, yep, all rapidly corrected with supplemental O2.
And another way of saying that is 19 did not.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And I like it. You so I think you point out in here that you don't carry Keppra, you don't carry phenytoin, but you do carry ketamine, and it turns out that it looks like for these rare cases that it's appropriate. I like it. This is great research, and I think it gives us some really good ideas about what we can do for these really sick patients when our go-to drug is not working. Well, Dr. Shepke, thank you very much for talking to us. I like this research.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Next up is Tony Fernandez. Dr. Fernandez is presenting work that he has done with Drs. Rimley Crowe, Scott Bourne, and Brent Myers of ESO, and the title of the abstract is Prehospital Recognition of Patients Diagnosed with Sepsis and Septic Shock.
Looks like you were looking at some sepsis stuff.
Yes, we were, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
I'm happy to talk, and this was some interesting work. So there's been a lot of work lately about different ways to predict sepsis in the field for pre-hospital providers to actually recognize sepsis and subsequently to call a sepsis alert. And that led us to question, well, where are we now? Where is our baseline? How are we doing recognizing sepsis in the first place? So we set out to go identify this, answer this question. We had a hypothesis that based on one paper, because there's not really much literature in this area pre-hospitally. So there was a paper that said that paramedics recognize sepsis in about 30% of cases. Okay. So that was our hypothesis that we'd
That's
get
your prior.
Less than 30%. This was a retrospective study, and we used ESO's research data set for 2018. It has outcomes linked. We used only 911 medical responses, and these were adult patients who were non-trauma patients.
Okay.
So what we did was we identified sepsis patients using their ICD-10 codes. So if they had an ICD-10 code that was consistent with sepsis or septic shock, they were included in our population. And we sort of looked backwards. So we know that these are our sepsis patients, and we wanted to see what happened pre-hospitally. If the pre-hospital provider thought that the patient had sepsis based on their assessment.
Okay.
So again, we looked at, the way we did this was we looked at their provider's primary or secondary impression. And that does bring some limitations, and we'll talk about that shortly.
Okay.
But we looked at, there were 325,558 adult non-trauma patients with linked hospital records.
Maybe you could use a big data set next time.
Yes. We do have to strive to collect more data.
My friend uses a good N here.
Yes.
This is good, strong.
This is a good N. And even still, when we just looked at patients that had diagnosed with sepsis in hospital, that was only 5% of that 300,000, but that still gave us about 17,000 patients, 16,881.
And just to be clear, that 5% of the 325,000, those are folks that have linked outcome data in the data set.
Yes, they have linked outcome data and they were diagnosed with sepsis.
Do you happen to remember what the total denominator is? How many patients are in that data set to begin with?
Oh, yeah, the total data set is about 7.5 million patients.
Yeah, huge. Yes. So you got about 325,000 with outcome data.
With outcome data, yes.
And then you said 16,000 that have a sepsis.
They were diagnosed with sepsis, and then 3,000, a little over 3,000, 3,144 were diagnosed with septic shock. That was 20% of the sepsis patients.
Okay.
So we had a median age of 71. About 50-50 male, female, 82% white. This is the kicker right here.
Yeah.
Sepsis was recognized in 11% of sepsis cases. So that's less than an eighth had recognized sepsis.
Recognized by who?
So this was recognized by the pre-hospital, by either the paramedic or the EMT, and our definition of recognition was that they selected in the provider's primary or secondary impression field sepsis or septicemia. We put them together because it's a NEMSIS element. And the reason that we picked those two elements are because those are NEMSIS required elements. So states will have to require them, and most agencies have to submit them.
As opposed to, say, an alert or something like
correct.
That, which may not.
Yeah, exactly.
Good point.
So we looked at that. Now, we got only an eighth, right? So less than an eighth, 11%. Now, what's interesting here is we looked at some of the provider's primary impressions for our sepsis population for patients who were not identified pre-hospitally as sepsis. So in other words, their provider's primary impression or secondary impression was not sepsis.
Right.
So we wanted to see
With sepsis.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah. They were diagnosed with sepsis in the hospital. What do we think that they are in the field? And we found some things that are very consistent with sepsis.
Yeah.
The number one, 15%, was respiratory distress.
Yeah.
Another 13% was altered level of consciousness. 9% generalized weakness. We had 7% with fever or infection. And then we had another 6% with abdominal pain or problems.
Nice.
And these are all, again, consistent with sepsis. But one of the things that's pretty stark that we found was only 40% of the PCRs that we looked at had a documented temperature. So these things look like sepsis, and had they maybe taken a temperature, maybe that would have increased our percentage of sepsis recognition. And then we give the baseline vital signs for septic patients. There's really nothing remarkable that we saw in vital signs. They all look relatively normal. The median systolic blood pressure was 128. The median diastolic was 72. Heart rates were elevated. Median was of 104. And respiratory rates were slightly elevated, median of about 20. And you'd expect that in any of these patients. Just getting EMS there could do this to some patients. And then we looked at septic shock, and again, it was consistent with what you. They weren't unremarkable, but they weren't eye popping. The systolic blood pressure was 108, diastolic the median was 64, heart rate the median was 102, and again, the respiratory rate was 20.
So the thing that pops out to me about that is if you look at the SIRS criteria, which most of us are going off of, certainly the hospitals, your median heart rate in the field and in the hospital was above the criteria for 90.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one, and you only need two.
Yeah.
Your respiratory rate and median is 20. That's the cutoff. So half of the patients right there meet sepsis criteria.
That's a great point.
Or at least by SIRS criteria.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
And if they had the 60% that did not document a temperature, that probably could have pushed them over the edge and gotten you a lot better than an eighth. That's
absolutely
a good point.
Absolutely. And there are a few limitations to this. One of the limitations is, first of all, that we just looked at two fields. We looked at provider's primary impression, secondary impression.
Right.
So if they recorded in the narrative, or if, let's say, they documented that they did a sepsis protocol, we would have missed that in this analysis.
Right.
So that may add to the 11%. And then also, there's a lot of variation in the agencies that allow their data to be used in the ESO research data set.
Okay.
And we do not know which agencies had a sepsis protocol or maybe a sepsis, a system of care for sepsis in their region. There's going to be a lot of variation in this. But what we wanted to do was get some baseline numbers using a really large data set so we can understand where we are so we can get better.
It's great, great work. I really like it. Now, one of the questions that I have for you is, you have to, all researchers deal with the data that they have, not the data they want.
Absolutely.
So with that in mind, you're looking at an hospital ICD-10 code. Is that hospital ICD-10 coming from ED diagnosis or ultimate hospital diagnosis?
So that's a great point. And that's another limitation. So we have a mixture, because we could not pull them out at this time, of ED and hospital diagnosis. So the patient could have got septic in hospital.
Right.
And that would lead to an underestimation for sure.
So, I think one of the other things you can do, one of the things that strikes me is as I'm looking at the top five EMS provider impressions when sepsis was not documented. Again, everybody in this population had sepsis.
Yep.
I see respiratory distress, so that would certainly suggest a respiratory etiology.
Absolutely.
For this. Altered level of consciousness and generalized weakness. All I can see, 90% of my patients are old and have a UTI, and that's their source, and
sure.
That would be entirely consistent with that. Tony, I think this is great work. Thank you so much for doing the work and for, you know, giving us a good baseline of ways that we can improve with sepsis. And most importantly, thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity. I think this was a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot, man.
Okay, I enjoyed it.
Appreciate it.
Okay, y'all remember when I said up front this was going to be a longer pod than usual? Well, we're about a third of the way through, and we're already longer than I'd like. So I decided I'm going to break this sucker up into several different pods. There's just so much goodness to be had during these conferences. We'll be back in your feed sooner than usual with the rest of these interviews. Until then, take care, y'all.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project Podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridgeEd podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information.